Our next speaker is Frank Briley. Frank returned to philosophy 10 years ago after 40 years post-first degree life in the commercial world. He's a familiar person to many of us here, and he's a previous chairman of the Philosophical Society and previous winner of the Chadwick Prize. Frank.
Tom. I shouldn't do this. I'm going to beg indulgence. I finished this at 4:15 this morning, and I've just been reading it through for the first time, and there are a few typos and stuff in it, so forgive me. We'll get over those. So, the talks on perception, and I'm going to talk about sensory perception. That isn't the sort of perception, that was a very perceptive remark, or I can perceive a flaw in your argument. My subject concerns the five senses: visual, auditory, gustatory, olfactory, and tactual, and any others by which we acquire knowledge about the material world. And that there are another 18 have been sort of dredged up from somewhere by people. These might well start with proprioception, kinesthesia, ways that we know about ourselves, and the vestibular sense of judging balance. The focus of the philosophy of perception is rather different from the kind of questions that Peter was looking at in epistemology, like what is knowledge and what is belief. But it's certainly relevant to the foundation of knowledge and to justification, about which Peter, I think, if you're a bit diffident, didn't like it very much. But it's certainly relevant, it's concerned with our very connection to the world via our sense organs, which seem to provide us with direct and immediate access to external reality. Tim Crane, in his article on perception in the Stanford Encyclopedia, suggests that the most important task of philosophical theories of perception is to preserve the central intuition about perceptual experience, its openness to the world. In fact, I think beyond that, we have a need for comfort that such openness should provide us with a true and faithful picture of the world, in other words, a firm base for empirical knowledge. And that, of course, is the common sense picture. I mean, it's pretty damn obvious. How do I know there's a cat in front of me now? Because I can see it, I can touch it, I can hear it. But philosophy can make a mystery out of almost anything. Isn't that what philosophy is? Creating and then failing to solve mysteries. David Hume's one of the philosophers who put perhaps that very cat among the pigeons, or maybe I should say among the vulgar. It was their common sense that Hume said it took only a little philosophy to destroy. He was then in the process of casting sceptical doubt on our knowledge of the external world, first recalling a Cartesian approach and using examples of illusion like the crooked appearance of an oar in water, and the double images which arise from pressing one's eye. In order, I quote, to prove that the senses alone are not implicitly to be depended upon, but that we must correct their evidence by reason and by considerations derived from the nature of the medium, the distance of the object, and the disposition of the organ, in order to render them within their sphere the proper criteria of truth and falsehood. However, he continues, there are other more profound arguments against the senses which admit of not so easy a solution. He then chooses the example of an illusion to attack men's natural instinct or prepossession to repose faith in their senses without any reasoning. His example is that of a table, which he says seems to diminish as we move farther from it. But of course, it's a ridiculous example because a table doesn't seem to shrink any more than a coin seems to be elliptical if we look at it anyway than head on. But let's forgive him the bad example. and listen to his brief and succinct exposition of the famous argument from illusion and the use he makes of it to launch his version of what has since been called the sense data theory of perception. I say his version because, of course, it's been long held that the immediate objects of perception were ideas of the head. I mean, we go back to the early modern philosophers, Descartes and so on, and the whole idea of perception was that what we perceived was not the objects out there, but their representations as ideas in the head. Hume says, but the real table, which exists independent of us, suffers no alteration. It was, therefore, nothing but its image, which was present to the mind. These are the obvious dictates of reason, and no man who reflects ever doubted that the existences which we consider when we say this house or that tree are nothing but perceptions in the mind and fleeting copies or representations of other existences which remain uniform and independent. I'll say more about the argument from illusion and also its twin, the argument from hallucination. They're very important because they're a threat to our basic intuition about the knowledge-giving reliability of our senses. So in a way, they have shaped every theory of perception. Every theory has had to deal with them, either by accepting them or deploying counter-arguments. But first, I'll just point out one peculiarity of Hume's presentation. How, we might ask, can he argue from the real table which exists independent of us and suffers no alteration? If his only evidence for the existence of that table comes from the sense perception from which he will tell us we could derive no firm evidence for the existence of enduring external objects. All I want to say about that at present is that he's taking a realist stance. He's examining perception as a phenomenon in a world of real concrete objects, and the theories I shall be looking at are all theories which assume realism as their starting point. I shall mention idealism briefly, but it won't really figure. The argument from illusion, in its simplest form, can be set out in five stages. One, when viewing a straight stick half submerged in water, one is directly aware of something bent. Two, no relevant, mind-independent physical thing is bent in this situation. Three, therefore, in this situation, one is directly aware of something non-physical. Four, what one is directly aware of in this situation is subjectively indiscriminable from the kind of thing that one is directly aware of in normal, non-illusory perception. And five, therefore, there's no reason to suppose that even in the case of genuine perception, one is directly or immediately aware of ordinary objects, but only of non-physical mental objects. Howard Robinson, who's a current sense data proponent, has summarized part of that argument into his phenomenal principle, which says, if there sensibly appears to a subject to be something which possesses a particular sensible quality, then there is something of which the subject is aware which does possess that sensible quality. Hallucinations are like illusions in being non-veridical perceptions. Perceptions as of some external object, but as it happens, that something does not exist. After images are an example. The argument from hallucination is very similar to the argument from illusion, and I'll just give it in three stages. One, hallucinations where no mind-independent object is perceived are subjectively indistinguishable from genuine perceptions. Two, since they are thus of the same kind, it cannot be that the essence of perception depends upon the mind's independent existences of their perceptual objects. And three, therefore, ordinary perceptual experience is of mind-dependent objects. Both arguments are deployed, as by Hume, to undermine the so-called naive realist or common sense view. The perception normally gives us direct access to how the world is. No blackboard, didn't ask for one. So that's my fault. I was going to write up these things as they came up. So naive realist is the first, and then the next one is sense data theory. But they're all, are they listed in your handout? I think so. Arguments from illusion and hallucination are generally accepted by sense data proponents. People like C.D. Broad, Bertrand Russell, H.H. Price, A.J. Eyre, and current sense data proponents, E.J. Lowe and Howard Robinson. But they do need to argue their case. They can't just leap off the arguments from hallucination and illusion. One aspect of sense data theory is that we have sometimes called incorrigible, but certainly direct access to the so-called sense data, these mental entities. And that is supposedly in their favour against naive realists who claim to have equally direct access to the world. Eyre has some discomfort in denying that, in fact, to the naive realists, and claiming he has this discomfort in denying them direct perception of the external world and claiming that relation exclusively for our awareness of sense data. He acknowledges the fact that the naive realist's so-called direct perception must be mediated by any number of physical, physiological, and mental causal links between himself and the external object, not to mention their time separation in the case of seeing stars that may no longer exist. But there seems to Eyre to be no good reason why, in the case of veridical perception, one should semantically not allow that perceptions of a blue carpet as blue or of a star as twinkling are directly of the objects themselves. So he turns to other reasons to adopt. He doesn't think that's a good argument against the naive realists, and you'll see later on that disjunctivists agree with him. He, like other sense data theorists, accepts that the generalizing step, which I'll point out in those two arguments, holds good. So it's in the view of the subjective indiscriminability of veridical from non-veridical perception, all perception must be of mind-independent objects. I don't know if you noticed that generalizing step. It was given in the argument from illusion between 4 and 5. One is directly aware of this. What one is directly aware of in this situation is subjectively indiscriminable from the kind of thing that one is directly aware of in normal, non-illusory perception. Therefore, there is no reason to suppose that even in cases of genuine perception, etc. In other words, if it happens in cases of illusion and hallucination, because we can't discriminate these subjectively, because I don't know sometimes that I'm seeing an illusion or a hallucination, if there is no difference in my kind of subjective personal experience, I can't claim that anything is different when I am seeing veridically than from when I am not. That is the generalizing step. And that, of course, is one of the things that has been challenged in these arguments. Sense data theory has been called an act-object theory because of the separation of the act of perception from the objects perceived. There's also a variety of indirect realism, known as representationalist, since sense data are representations. It's been found unsatisfactory on a variety of grounds by many philosophers, who have therefore developed alternative theories to overcome their objections. One rather logical objection comes from those who accept the arguments from illusion and hallucination, which seem to leave us with nothing but perceptions. These philosophers, instead of making the Cartesian and Humean realist assumption about the existence of the external world, for lack of evidence, treat the perceptual as the whole of reality. These, of course, are the idealists and phenomenalists, for whom the universe is entirely a mental construction. As I said before, I'm not going to pursue that route, apart from noting that one defence on behalf of the sense data theorists is their claim that the sense data don't put a barrier between us and the external world, but should be treated rather as the medium whereby we perceive the external world. I'll now turn to two other alternatives to sense data theory: adverbial theory, which I shall mention briefly, and intentionalism, which is the most prevalent theory of perception. Adverbial theorists like Chisholm and Ducasse pursue a naturalist objection to sense data as mysterious mental entities that have no place in science or philosophy, identifiable by other means than except as the means of filling an explanatory gap. Of course, such abductive inference to best explanation may be quite acceptable in lieu of even better explanation, but then the adverbialists think they can provide that. They dismiss mental entities and concentrate on the phenomenal nature of perceptual experience. Remember the phenomenal principle, which says if there sensibly appears to be a subject to a subject to be something which possesses a particular sensible quality, then there is something of which the subject is aware which does possess that sensible quality. Largely accepting this principle, the adverbialists, instead of instantiating the quality in sense data, see the quality, quale, if you like, as modifying the experience itself. To quote Crane, and I would incidentally, if you want to read more on this subject, I have heavily plundered Crane's article in the Stanford encyclopedia, which is easily accessible on the internet. That is a superb source for philosophy. You've used it a lot, haven't you, Peter? So quoting Crane's article, when someone has about adverbialists, when someone has an experience, something like brownness is instantiated, but in the experience itself rather than its object. That is not to say that the experience is brown, but rather that the experience is modified in a certain way, the way we can call perceiving brownly. I'm not going to say much more about them because the adverbialists don't hold much sway these days. They did get round some problems, but then I think they created others for themselves. And apart from the fact that we're into qualia, which are extremely controversial area, and various other objections to them, I think the most telling objection is that adverbialism fails to explain adequately just how perception relates the perceiver to the outside world. Answers are given to the objection, but they fail to gain much support. Instead of considering them, I'll move on to intentionalism. Intentionalism is another form of indirect realism, accepting the existence of the external world, but it borrows from the philosophy of propositional attitudes, the idea that what is presented to the mind, for example in belief, is not necessarily true. Represent is the key word, and one version of intentionalism is called representationalism, but of a very different kind from the sense data theory. Sense data theory not only treats sense data as representations, but as the objects of perception. Intentionalism does away with those embarrassing intermediaries and treats experience itself as representing how things are. This enables it to attack the argument from illusion by denying its first premise that when viewing a straight stick half submerged in water, one is directly aware of something bent. In representational terms, it's not invariably true that if a mental state represents O as A, there must actually be something which is A. Mike Martin, who is another prominent philosopher in the field of perception, but particularly disjunctivism, points out there's a world of difference between Mary believes there are sweets in the tube and there are sweets believed by Mary to be in the tube. Here again, how the phenomenal principle disregards that difference. It says, if the sensibly appears to a subject to be something which possesses a particular sensible quality, then there is something of which the subject is aware which does possess that quality. Representationalism doesn't have to accept that, because experience merely represents how the world is, so it can misrepresent. By denying intentionalism, by denying that there must be a something, can avoid the conclusions, the arguments from illusion and hallucination, that when no such something exists in the mind-independent world, the something must be a mind-dependent thing. In the case of illusion, the phenomenal experience of perceiving merely misrepresents the world in some way. In the case of hallucination, it represents something that does not exist, or at least nothing that exists within perceptual range of the subject. However, when veridical perceptual experience represents the world accurately and without any intermediary objects of perception, and so in a sense may be called direct, the intentionalist theory denies that the essential phenomenal nature of perceptual experience is constituted by, or wholly determined by, the external objects that are perceived. We're going to see interesting contrasts with that view coming up. That's an important point. It's due to the common kind assumption, which I'll explain soon, and then return to in the context of disjunctivism. We're not through with isms yet, I'm afraid. Intentionalism thus ditches mental objects and denies a direct relation to any objects. Even veridical perception, being representational, is not direct perception. I go along with intentionalism's refusal to allow that the phenomenal nature of perceptual experience is determined by the external object of perception on two grounds. First, although clearly the external object is the physical and mental focus of the experience, it's only one of the many causal conditions responsible for producing it. In vision, for example, the quality, strength, and direction of the light striking the object, the physical relation of the object relative to the perceiver, influences on the course and quality of the light thereafter through maybe air, gas, water, and certainly the eye, physiological processing by the subject's visual system from the retina to the brain, and the subject's own state of mind, all these affect the perceptual experience, the way the object is represented in vision. And then there's the common kind assumption. This says that perception and misperception are experiential states with the same fundamental character. They are a common kind. This is based on the fact that illusion and hallucination are not subjectively discriminable from veridical perception. But also, they're also unreliant on there actually being an object. There are some thought experiments in the philosophy of perception whereby someone is veridically seeing something, and by messing around with the brain state is retained, the object is removed, and the subject can't tell the difference. Now, they may be thought experiments, but one can understand what that means. In other words, the perception and misperception can't be distinguished either by mental state or by brain state. They're a common kind. Some more comments on... How am I doing? It's...
You've got 7 minutes.
Right. Though perceptual intentionalism arose from the intentional theory of proposition attitudes, and some early intentionalists identified perceptual experiences with beliefs, there are real differences between them. One of these is that however much it's true of perception, that it opens us to the world, it's quite possible for a perception to persist alongside a contradictory belief, as happens in the case of the famous Müller-Lyer diagram, which you've got a picture of on the back of your handouts there. You look at the two lines, and although you know they are the same length, the two parallel lines, the illusion persists that one of them is longer than the other. That can't happen with beliefs. There's Moore's paradox, not P, but I believe P, brings it home. We can't have two explicit contradictory beliefs at the same time. David Armstrong once saw perception as being the acquisition of a belief, but to accommodate believed illusions, like the Müller-Lyer diagram, he withdrew to calling it a potential belief or an inclination to believe. But not many philosophers agree even now with that withdrawal position. Still debated whether all intentional states are maybe propositional attitudes, and that would include perception. But it's pointed out that many perceptual statements themselves, although they take the form of propositional attitudes, S perceives experiences that P, with a truth value for P, they're also both perceptual statements, like I see an elephant, and other intentional statements, like Mary loves John, which are not propositional attitudes. So that is a hard course to row. I'm going to skip over one or two things, conceptual content and objections to intentionalism. Qualia is one of them, and there are two schools of thought here. There are strong intentionalists who say, yes, it's part of perceptual experience, that it's qualitative. And there are weak intentionalists who allow in qualia as non-intentional. I would take, because I would put myself very much in the camp of the representationalist intentionalists, I would take the strong intentionalist line. The second objection accuses intentionalism, in fact all indirect realist theories, of losing that most basic fact of perception or requirement, its openness to the world. We saw that intentionalism denies a direct relation between the subject and the external objects of his perception. The causal links between perceiver and object not only connect, but separate him from the world. Moreover, the common kind assumption, by recognizing the same kind of fundamental experiential state characterizes both perception and misperception, prevents that state from ever being more than representational, because it has to allow for the non-veridicality of experiences which misrepresent reality. So in a sense, it cannot be open to the world, this is intentionalism, and so presumably fails what Crane considered the most important task of philosophical theories of perception, which was to preserve this central intuition about perceptual experience. The typical intentionalist reply, to quote Crane, is to argue that the very idea of perceptual representation as such does not lead to a veil of perception, any more than the very idea of linguistic representation leads to a veil of words. So that seems to me a slightly weak response. But it leads me on to the people who are making these objections, who are the disjunctivists. And I don't know, Tom, where you got it from that I was going to support one of these positions. I'm not going to. but the final one I'm coming to is disjunctivism. The disjunctivist wants to preserve that central intuition about perceptual experience, and so insists that the phenomenal character of perceptual experience of mind-independent objects owes its very character to those objects. The distinctivist must consequently deny the common kind assumption, which refuses to distinguish phenomenally between at least hallucinatory and veridical perceptual experiences, and adopts the metaphysical stance that phenomenally, though subjectively indiscriminable by the subject, hallucinatory and veridical perceptual experiences are of fundamentally different kinds. That much is in common to all disjunctivists who do tend to come in kinds. I'm going to read out the view of an epistemological disjunctivist, the leading one, who is John McDowell. He'd put it that what is common to a genuine perception and a subjectively indistinguishable hallucination is the fact that the subject's experience is such that it appears to him that some environmental fact obtains. However, we should also accept that an appearance that such and such is the case can be either the fact that such and such is the case making itself perceptually manifest to someone, or a mere appearance. That near quotation from Matthew Sotirio commenting on McDowell is somewhat leaping into the deep end on disjunctivism, but it enables me to make a few immediate points. First, there are almost as many versions of disjunctivism as there are philosophers preaching it, but that isn't very many. Two of the most prominent are members of University College London, but Hilary Putnam is a convert. Secondly, McDowell's epistemological version focuses on how perception gives us knowledge of the world, because it's an epistemological version, rather than, for example, on the nature of the phenomenal experience of perception, which is Mike Martin's angle. McDowell adheres to the main disjunctivist tenet that perceptual experience comes in two distinct packages. Either it's veridical, which is exemplified by the world making itself directly known to us, both as it appears and as it is, or it's mere appearance, i.e. what appears to us, indiscriminable as it is from any other perceptual experience, is in the case of non-veridical experience, mere appearance. This either-or explains the name disjunctivism. Another variety, espoused by Michael Martin, who has resurrected naive realism from being, as it was for Hume, one of those quixotical windmills invented by philosophers for tilting practice, he claims that his naive realist version of disjunctivism, in which veridical perception is relational, and in which the perceptual object gives the experience its phenomenal character, is the least revisionary theory of perception. This is because it's preserving a lot of the original thinking in naive realism, and that it best fits our pre-theoretic views. Necessarily follows that misperception, though subjectively indiscriminable, is fundamentally different from veridical perception. This has to involve an externalistic view of the mind, though externalist is not a word that I've come across in reading Martin. If experience depends for its fundamental metaphysical nature on something which the experiencer can't detect, a perceptual experience can hardly be individuated on its experiential character, but presumably includes the object and the whole causal chain whereby that experience is enabled. This recalls Ayer's refusal to outlaw everyday perception of the world from being direct perception, on the grounds of the causal links separating the object from the perceiver. We could also consider that the perceptual experience may be thought of as supervening on the subject's body and environment together. The perceived object is a constituent of a perceptual experience. While the intentionalist sees the object's properties represented in perceptual experience, the disjunctivist sees them instantiated in perceptual experience. Time and ignorance prevent much further elucidation of disjunctivism. It's in a stage of undergoing its trials by fire at present. Here are a couple of the bullets being fired. First, that hallucinatory and veridical experiences, as well as having the same kind of brain states, are functionally and rationally identical. I react to a hallucination as I would to the perception, say, of seeing a stone thrown at me. I duck. Well, I don't think that troubles the disjunctivists anymore, because they just revert to their externalistic explanations. They've also been criticised because they refrain from giving any positive account of hallucinatory experience, leaving merely the negative idea of the second disjunct, that's the or bit, that it doesn't involve any relation with external reality. There isn't actually a response, but a possible reason they don't do that is that if they were to give a representative account of misperception, they could then be asked, well, why don't you just use that account for veridical perception as well? I'm afraid that's been a very rapid and somewhat superficial skate through the philosophy of perception. All I hope to do is give you some idea of the territory it covers, so I'll very briefly summarise it. From the starting point of the common sense idea of perception, that it's our five or more senses which give us perceptual knowledge of the world's objects, philosophy says, steady on, our senses can deceive us, all we know for sure are our sense impressions. So, we get sense data theorists who conclude that our direct perception is of mind-dependent objects, sense data, which are intermediaries between us and reality, and they may represent it veridically, illusorily, or an entirely non-existent reality. Then come the idealists and phenomenalists, who similarly conclude that our direct perception is of mind-dependent objects, sense data, if you like, and since we're cut off from any reality, any other reality by them, reality itself is phenomenal or ideal, a construct of ideas. The intentionalists deny that perception has to be in relation to objects at all. Our perceptual experiences certainly represents objects, but it can also misrepresent them. Disjunctivists cling to the common sense idea that perception truly informs us about the world and is indeed an openness to the world, and so hallucinations just can't have the same nature as informative, veridical perception. Either we have that true perceptual relation with the world, or it merely seems to us as it do. Naive realists just grin. Satisfaction, I think. Come back round to them. Okay.
I've had a request to use microphones. Have you got your mic? And just
switch it on.
Hello.
Is this working?
Because it needs to connect to the end. Chris, we haven't got much time actually. Yes.
Thank you. Very nice talk. Very interesting. And several times you use the word illusion and hallucination. And as somebody who's more sceptical since I was a young infant, and I suspect there are several others in the audience with the same experience, as soon as I removed my spectacles, the world was full of sort of fuzzy things. It looks like an impressionist painting. And my direct experience is not of sharp objects or distinct objects. As soon as I go to my optician, the optician produces a piece of technology with a distinct theory of optics and a theory of the external world built into it. So rather than perception giving me knowledge of the world, it's in fact my knowledge of the world that gives me my perception. So given that that statement, what category does that put me in your classification? Or a set state of theorists, or what?
I think there are a whole lot of marginal illusions. And whether we want to call them illusions or not, I think it's very difficult to say, and I'm not sure that's a question of philosophy. It's just the borderline meanings of our words. When is a game of chess not a game of chess? You remove three pawns from one side, and it's still chess. If you make the knights move different, is that still chess? I think it's the same with what counts as illusions or not. If I see a castle on a clear day, it's quite different from seeing it obscured by mist and rain. Is that non-veridical, that second time? Is it an illusion? You obviously don't have to be deluded to have an illusion, because that Müller-Lyer diagram shows that. You can be perfectly well aware of what the facts are, although your eyes are telling you something different. So that's not a question that comes into, if you like, the philosophy of perception, I think. It's much more a question for the philosophy of universals.
Right, that's it. Okay, Wendy? Thank you. Wendy,
for a very interesting roundup of the whole lot. I believe in all of us, but I've read a lot. But what surprises me is that the criterion seems to be between hallucination and illusion on the one hand and something veridical on the other. But they both have in common that you understand what it is you're seeing, and you can explain it and describe it, and somebody else can also explain where you've gone wrong or whatever. Or alternatively, if that is your belief, that is that X is the case, then other somebody else has to start with your point of view and explain where you are wrong, or try to understand where you are coming from and going to. That the real criterion is between something you understand and something you don't know what it is, like those strange pictures of things taken from a strange angle, or something you've never seen before, and you just don't know what it is, and at that point, you really can only discuss it in terms of sense data, such as it's brown, or it's red, or it's big, or it's small, or something like that. And it seems to me, from that point of view, what the difference really is between what you're seeing and what you're seeing it as, and that what you're seeing it as is very much where the mind is involved.
Yes, and how you see things, or we see them as, that's what we have to compare with what is actually there. So I have a perception as of an elephant, but I compare it with this, or you do. Oh, that must be a misperception, because that actually is a table. But it's this as of. That is my perception, which may be an illusion, or it may be veridical, or it may be a complete hallucination. Does that?
Yes,
but all the different, whether it's a sense data theory or a representational theory, and so on, they all pretty much agree on how you identify an illusion or a hallucination. What they disagree about is how to explain them. Obviously, I haven't quite got your point.
Well, it's the question between the difference between seeing an illusion, which you understand as something, and seeing something you do not understand what it is, and therefore you can only describe as sense data. Or alternatively, it is one of the things in an art student's program of learning is how to stop seeing things as and try to train them back to seeing what they see as actually there.
That is something, yes, which actually touches on a number of theories. One of them is the transparency of experience. I can look at a wall, or I can think about and consider the look of the wall.
and that involves seeing its, the components of that look. I see it's yellow, but now I see the shadows and the light playing on it, and I'm then looking at my experience, or at my experiencing of the wall. This is quite important in disjunctivism and in intentionalism, this sort of analysis, but there just isn't time, I'm afraid, to say exactly why.
Okay, it's tea time now anyway. Thank you very much, Frank. Right.